And welcome to another fun-filled episode of that 400KK podcast. Ari Rosenbaum here with, as always, Dan Venturi. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing great, sir. I am doing great. We're a week away, right?
Well, by the time the people hear this podcast, Denver will be in the books. So, you know, we really can't talk about, you know, go up to the website and sign up for it, because by the time they sign up for it, it's already happening.
Fair enough. Looking forward to it. How was your week?
Fine. Went to Pittsburgh for like a day or so to run some events with Lincoln Financial. So went to PNC Bank, which was great. Had a couple presentations, including one at this Top Golf in Pittsburgh, which is like a really nice golf range. Kind of like a Dave and Buster's for golf ranges. You know, they have half decent food, beer, this and that. And of course I had to leave early to catch my flight back, which of course was delayed, couldn't partake in the golf, but, it was a really fun event and, you know, always happy to help my friends out at Lincoln. Cassandra Churchill is always, a big help. She was a big help with the conferences in the beginning. Yeah, we had a lot of fun. So, And she got good tickets for the Pirates, so it was fun. And we talked that we'll probably, you know, with God willing, we'll be at that 401k conference sometime maybe next year in Pittsburgh. And I'm thinking probably more Heinz Field than PNC Park, because I think it's more of a Steelers town than a Pirates town.
Yeah, did the Pirates win the game you saw?
They lost. They lost to the Braves. They got crushed. They were winning, and they just blew it at the end. I we left like the eighth inning. They were like, I think they lost like 12-5 or something. I don't even know what. So Denver's done. Next will be Cleveland, September 20th. Going to be a lot of fun. Game that night against the Phillies. Then we got the event in October at Foxborough, Gillette Stadium. MetLife will probably announce in the next couple weeks once we finally book that for November. And then December, AT&T Stadium, Arlington, Texas. And, of course, that 401k National Conference in Disney World next March 2020. Please sign up. Go to that 401ksite.com. We have a limited amount of rooms, and it's going to be a fun-filled couple of days out there in Disney World. So, anyway, today's topic is a variation of the presentation that I have done in Pittsburgh and I've done for Lincoln Financial in Boston as well. And it's talking really about the 2019, you know, developments in the retirement plan business and how that really could affect you as a plan provider. And number one, when it comes to the 2019, probably first things first, probably the newest stuff first, is the fiduciary rule. The SEC has a proposal out on their new fiduciary rule, and Department of Labor says that they're going to develop one in December. It'll be their third time at bat in trying to change the fiduciary rules governing retirement plans that have been in place since ERISA was first developed and first passed in 1974. Obviously, a lot of things have changed in the retirement plan business since 74. So we'll see what happens with the Department of Labor proposing. Maybe it'll be more in line with what the SEC has. Your guess is as good as mine. They do come out with a new rule. Expect ERISA attorneys making some more money on helping these brokerage firms develop some sort of approach again. So, no matter what the lawyers make out, that was always the joke in law school when I had a bankruptcy professor says, you know why they change the bankruptcy rules every couple years? Keep the bankruptcy attorneys in business. And that's somehow that's how I feel about ERISA attorneys. You know, we every 6 years we have a restatement. You know, pays our bills. So we'll see what happens with that. Obviously, with the fiduciary rules, the states are trying to regulate it. And of course, you know, one development is, of course, that plan sponsors are asking more and more about fiduciary solutions, 316, 338, that sort of deal. So it's always at the top of our list and the top of our considerations.
Let me ask you, how different is the proposed SEC rule from what got
It's more watered down, going back to some sort of like best interest exemption. It's even more watered down than that. It really doesn't have that much teeth. We'll see what happens with that proposal, where that goes. you know, if Wall Street loves it or Wall Street's supportive of it, then RIAs are not. And RIAs think that it doesn't really have any teeth. So we'll see what happens. To me, anything proposed, I like things in finality. You know, people did like these wrote articles about the Secure Act that the House of Representatives passed for MEPs and stretch IRAs and all that stuff. And it's like I don't even bother until I see something signed into law. Proposals are nice, and it's always nice to be abreast of what's, you know, the thinking of Congress. But until you see a new, you know, law in place, to me, it's kind of premature. I mean, and that's the same thing that goes with MEPs, which is one of those 2019 developments. And, you know, the House did develop the Secure Act. Senate's got their RESA proposal. They haven't passed that yet. I assume that they will, and I assume that they'll have to have a conference between the two houses to have bills that, you know, pass legislation that will be similar, that will meet, and, you know, Trump probably would sign it. But, you know, talking about MEPs, you know, I had the discussion and I wrote an article about it, and we've talked about it, when dealing with that HR association. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, most MEPs that I've ever worked with, really take off. You know, on paper, they look like great ideas, but in terms of getting people on board, that's always been a difficult process. You know, I could count on my hands how many successful MEPs I've been a part of. I could probably count on a couple hands how many unsuccessful MEPs I've been a part of, one way or the other. And, you know, the cost savings, I think, is the big deal, because until you hit like a critical mass, you don't really have that cost savings. And I think the audit is probably the biggest issue that nobody really wants to talk about. You know, unless you got 1,000 people, you know, under your belt, that audit proposition is going to be crippling for any type of, you know, variation of an open MEP, or just any MEP, a closed MEP for that matter. Anytime you have 100 participants or more, you get that audit, and, you know, you got a $10,000 fee. Participants going to have to bear a heavy burden of that, or, you know, the plan sponsor is going to have to eat some of that as well.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the MEPs we have, you know, they're isolated to a private equity firm, so that's a slightly different elephant. I think MEPs have had some success in the PEO world. But to your point, you know, the crucial element is if you're going down that road, you have to get yourself over at least that 100 participant mark. You know, otherwise, it's probably not going to really take flight.
Right. I mean, you know, and again, we all have great ideas on paper, and then we develop them, and it turns out that they fail. You know, a lot of things that are can't miss, you think they're can't miss, and it's really hard to bring adopting employers in. You know, with the successful MEPs that I've had, it's take upwards of 3 to 5 years to really get off the ground and reach a level of critical mass that, you know, the audit doesn't become a problem anymore. I have one client in particular, employer organization, very successful, long time. They developed the MEP. I think we're in year 4, maybe. And they're still subsidizing the cost of the audit. So, you know, it's a slow process. And you don't want to hit a participant for $100 for an audit. You know, the idea is you have cost savings. And if you're, you know, making a MEP full of these small employers and you have this audit charge, it really becomes a problem in terms of the costs. And, you know, as a plan sponsor doesn't want to eat that audit fee. So, you know, it's a slow process. And unless you could get, you know, avenues to facilitate the sales, it's going to be an uphill struggle. You know, and I've sponsored some open MEPs. I sponsored one open MEP in the past around the time the advisory opinion came out, and it was a flop. It just didn't work out. And, you know, it is what it is.
Well, let's hope our HR association doesn't encounter a similar a similar fate.
Well, you know, just developing a plan and saying, oh, this is great. You know, we're looking at other avenues and other platforms to, you know, sell products and services. And so we have that. But, you know, if we were just a map, I think that would be, you know, just a much harder thing to develop, to stand out amongst, you know, every other solution that's out there. So we'll see how we go.
We'll see what happens.
Exactly.
I think we got a good deal, though. I think we're on the right path.
Oh, I think so, too. Let's look at some of the other developments. Shelf space payments. Our friends at Fidelity got targeted because they were getting shelf space payments from mutual funds as some sort of mechanism to replace the loss of revenue sharing. We know that because of a lawsuit against Fidelity, some investigation of Fidelity, and some, you know, proprietary, I think, emails with Fidelity acknowledging that they need this shelf space payment arrangement in order to be successful in the 401k plan space. And I think shelf space payments, to me, another way of developing a runaround revenue sharing. If it's a shelf space payment between a mutual fund and a custodian, they'll argue that it didn't come under the fee disclosure arrangements because it's not a plan asset. But my feeling is that if there's enough screaming about it, the Department of Labor would change the regulations and require these payments to be disclosed as well. And when I was in Pittsburgh and I was talking about it, I was talking to a advisory firm that does work with one of these providers that offer shelf space payments, and you know, they asked me about it. I said, you know what? If you know what the fee is, disclose it. You know, it's got nothing to do with you, but disclose it anyway. Disclose it's being done because even though it's not putting money in your pocket, you don't want to be accused by a plan sponsor when another advisor comes along and says, oh, by the way, did you know your plan's funds pay shelf space payments? And then the plan sponsor's like, oh, my God, the guy, my advisor didn't tell me. To me, being transparent and being really transparent and disclosing everything, it makes you look better. And you don't want to be, you know, everything's in the retirement plan business is all about trust. And if you give a plan sponsor a reason not to trust you, it's not going to end well for you.
So what? Shed a little bit more light on exactly what Fidelity is being investigated for, basically taking payments from fund companies for access on their platform?
Yeah.
Suggested platforms?
Yeah, they basically no longer want somebody like Vanguard to get a free ride, you know, to you know, and you understand their point. I mean, the platform does cost money, and, you know, if you're on the Fidelity platform, you should be using Fidelity funds. I mean, you know, I mean that's the reason why, I guess, you're on the Fidelity platform. But, you know, it's just really interesting, you know. You know, it's just really a, you know, interesting development. And, you know, I think advisors are best to, you know, be transparent about it. And again, I just think that these shelf space payments are not going to last. Years ago, I predicted, I said, well, you know, when revenue sharing ends, they're going to try to develop new ways to charge to make up for this. And I know producing TPA years ago when the fee disclosure regulations were proposed, their runaround about not disclosing revenue sharing was now that they were going to disclose revenue sharing, they were going to create a custodial daily access fee of 50 bips or so, 25 bips. And anybody, I think it was 25 bips, and anybody who knows anything about retirement plans is, I think, the most expensive custodian that probably charges 9 bips, maybe. So it was their way of padding a fee and taking into the fact that they now have to disclose revenue sharing and show it, you know, dollar for dollar. So, you know, back then I predicted, you know, there'll be people who's going to, you know, try to develop ways to charge for revenue sharing and make up for it, because it's a big loss for these TPAs, for these custodians. Especially, you know, somebody like Fidelity and some of the other larger platforms. And, you know, it's going to be a challenge because not everybody's going to charge it. And you've got, you know, ERISA litigators, and you've got, DOL, and you got the state regulators after you. So I don't know. I just think that eventually what's going to happen is that way is going to go bye-bye as well. I just don't think that it's going to stand for it, because you know, in the end of the day, it's pay to play. When you think about it, you know, I understand their point. People using Vanguard funds. Vanguard doesn't pay. I get that. Vanguard can't pay. That's a whole nother story. But we'll see what happens. But it's a really concern. And like I said, I think advisors should really be err on the side of caution. If they know that these funds that they're using is doing that, you know, that's going to be a problem. So next on our list, of course, are DOL audits, late deferral deposits. Right now, I'm in the middle of two big audits dealing both with restaurant groups that had late deferral deposits, and these are slow, agonizing processes. You know, when it comes to late deferral deposits, no plan sponsors one and done. If they missed one, they missed two. If they missed three, they missed five, whatever it is. They never just miss one, and it's becoming a big, big problem, especially when they answer on the 5500, and then the Department of Labor doesn't have a record of, submission to the Voluntary Fiduciary Compliance Program, and, you know, it's a great way to get audited. So, as a 316, Dan, what do you do with plan sponsors that are late?
Yeah, that's a dicey one. Yeah, we try really hard to prevent them from being late, but at the same time, it's difficult to, you know, bird dog stuff all the time, right? The egregious ones, they'll get a ping, a call, an email, something to that effect. But, you know, that one client that should be submitting them in 5 days but submits them in 8 or 9, you know, that's one of those things where, you know, we kind of wait to see what happens with the audit, if the auditors are sticklers about deeming those, we'll address them, you know. Otherwise, we're hoping there's enough of a precedent there that if push does come to shove, we can finesse it through an audit. But it is tough. I mean, you know, we've got some plan sponsors that if we don't turn the payroll around in 24 hours, we're hearing from them. And then we have others, like I just said, that are routinely sort of straddling the line between, you know, timely and untimely. So there's, and this is sort of a sloppy answer to your question, Ari, but I don't think there's one catch-all solution, right? I will tell you that I've had discussions with auditors, both sides of the coin. I've had discussions with auditors that weren't deeming or didn't want things to be deemed untimely that I felt were egregious enough to come up in an audit, and there were other times that you know, the auditor was hyper vigilant, and you know, we sort of had to talk him down off the ledge there. But if it gets to a form 5500, especially these days, the deal is a lot more proactive. You know, a couple of our clients have gotten those, just letting you know this is a problem letter from the DOL. You know, and I know I've asked you to do a couple of these recently. You know, the 5330 filings. Yeah, if they're on the 5500, get them off as soon as you can. You know, the longer they stay on, the more subsequent 5500s that are filed with the same thing. I would think that significantly increases your chance of being audited. So if it's there, address it quickly and move on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, You got to be vigilant. I think that auditors who think, oh, a week late, you know, it's no big deal. I don't feel comfortable doing that. I just think that once you're outside of the norm, if you have a practice where you're, you know, 3 to 5 days or whatever it is, and you do 7, you got a problem. Just the auditors on the Department of Labor side doing the audits, they're being more and more vigilant, and they're being tougher when it comes to determining what's late and what's not. They don't let things go like they used to in the old days. So it's a really troubling aspect of it. And really, a plan sponsor needs to keep a process in place that they follow and make sure that it's timely deposited. It's really annoying.
that it is.
Yep.
That it is.
Another, of course, issue we've always talked about is the definition of compensation. It's been coming up a lot lately. Plan sponsors thinking that their plan has one definition of compensation, but the plan document says something else. And that usually sometimes will require the employer to make up a contribution, solid deferral opportunity, possibly, or, you know, a profit-sharing contribution. You know, they think that they're not supposed to match or give a profit sharing based on bonuses, but the plan document includes bonuses. That's something, and we see that more often lately than not.
Yeah, that's a big one. We talk about that a lot. That happens a lot more than I think you or I would care to admit. And there are a number of reasons for it, right? I mean, turnover, internal turnover. The folks that put in the plan aren't there anymore. Generally change, any kind of change is potential for an issue.
Right. I mean, it's just another, anything outside of the norm when it comes to retirement plans, kind of, occasionally you're kind of asking for it to get screwed up. So if you have a definition of compensation that, is kind of outside the box, excluding bonuses is outside the box, excluding car allowances, that sort of thing, it's problematic because, most a lot of TPAs, they only develop what's, inside the box. And, the plan document, you assume it says one thing, and a lot of times it says another. I have a plan sponsor right now. They thought their eligibility was one way, but, they kept, for some reason, every time the plan document was redone, there was a change in the eligibility requirements. And, the problem is that quite a few got added in that shouldn't have been in. So, it's a problem.
Yeah. That's one we deal with that pretty routinely.
Yeah, I mean, it's, frequently happening. More lately than usual. And next and final on my list, consolidation in the business. I went to 401k Help Center this morning, seeing what's out there in the terms of the news, trying to get some ideas on topics that I should cover in my own blog posts. And a certain friendly TPA of ours, a big national TPA, just bought another two TPAs this week.
Really?
Yeah, and it's just amazing. The landscape of the retirement plan business over the last couple of years, and our friends, the friends are Ascensus, and they just bought another two TPAs. Chernoff Diamond, which is a TPA I know here out here in Long Island, they got bought out last couple weeks by USI. So you're getting a lot of consolidation in this industry. Our TD Ameritrade is exiting the custodial business. I think they sold their custodial business to Broadridge Matrix, whatever, and as more and more players exit the industry, the question is, what happens to the lack of competition? Does that increase pricing or is it decrease pricing? But most importantly, let's look at the human resources aspect of it. That means less jobs for people in this industry. Consolidation does equal less jobs in this industry. We see that with Oppenheimer being bought out by Invesco. Quite a few people that we know, well, I don't know people from Oppenheimer that will let go. My friends at Oppenheimer are sticking around. But you go on LinkedIn and just see, quite a few people, it's a long farewell. And, that's a tough one.
It's inevitable, unfortunately. You see it in a lot of industries. As things get more established, as the industry gets more mature.
Right.
Right. I mean, what does the industry really go back to? The mid 80s?
Right.
I think it's inevitable. I think there'll be consolidation, but at the same time, I think the additional scrutiny, the additional, you know, regulatory attention, plaintiff's bar, all that, all these different forces that are sort of coalescing to reshape the industry. In the long run, it'll probably lead to some job creation, right? It'll just be different jobs. It might not be, you know, a TPA administrator anymore. Maybe it's a 316 or, you know, an additional audit job, you know, something along those lines.
We'll hope. But, you know, it's troubling to, you know, see so many, like Long Island was a bastion of a lot of TPAs, and they're consolidating. And, you know, I think there's less opportunity for people to be in this industry. You know, once there's consolidation, the next thing are, you know, we got to get rid of the people that duplicate services or, you know, duplicative positions. So, you know, that's a concern. If you're an independent TPA and, you know, somebody's developing into be the 900-pound gorilla in the room, I mean, it can be disturbing. But, you know, it's an ever-changing business. And quite honestly, I saw this with fee disclosure regulations. You knew that was going to happen. Some of the large insurance providers, like the Hartford, I mean, they left the business. For some reason, they thought they could no longer compete. Wells Fargo is selling, you know, their business, and, you know, they're just a whole host of people that just cashing out for one reason or the other, and so, you know, we'll see what happens. But there's, you know, there's still enough competition out there that you still could stand out among the crowd and still develop a pretty decent practice. So that's going to be it for this week. And we hope to hear from you guys. Well, we hope you tune in next week. We'll probably record something in Denver. I got to bring out my microphone and whatnot. So we got looking forward to that. And, of course, go to that41ksite.com for more information on all our events, especially the Disney event, which we're really, you know, hoping to be really successful and a fun national event, something you've never really seen before. You know, you will see again, hopefully, when we do a second event. So for Dan and I, so long, farewell, avida zain, goodbye.
Have a great weekend, guys.
Take care.
See you next time.
Bye.